Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzstrauber. On today's show, should sex offenders be allowed to use social media? A North Carolina law said no. Supreme Court said yes. How did we get to a point where the Supreme Court in North Carolina were battling over sex offenders' rights to use social media? And what does this case say about broader themes, like how similar the virtual world is to the real world? And is a playground or a school where you can clearly restrict someone from being present, is that similar to a social media site where, of course, children are able to access and use the platform? Joining me to discuss this interesting case is Katie Glenn, policy counsel at the First Amendment Partnership, whose mission is to promote and protect religious freedom for people of all faiths. Katie, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the guy who started this whole case is Lester Packingham, a registered sex offender. He was arrested in 2010 for posting a Facebook status about a dismissed ticket. He said, quote, "No court, no fees, praise be to God." Wow. How did that post end up kicking off a Supreme Court battle over whether sex offenders are allowed to use Facebook?
So several years ago, North Carolina passed a law that kept all sex offenders, everyone on the registry in that state, off of basically all social media sites, but a lot of other websites we wouldn't traditionally consider to be social media, things like Amazon, eBay, WebMD, and IMDb.
So a lot of e-commerce and just informational websites too.
Basically any website where a person can make a username and interact with others, even if it's not required to make a username to use that website. So there's even discussion of whether Wikipedia would fall under this, which I know I use all the time. I think most of us do. So he posted on Facebook about this traffic ticket that he beat. There had been no use of the internet with his initial case. There was nothing in his specific probation that required him to stay off the internet other than this broad law. But someone saw the post in the local police department. They sort of put it together because this guy had beat his ticket. He was using a fake name on Facebook, but they connected the two through searching his IP address, and then it violated his probation, sending him back to jail.
So how did he end up on the sex offender registry in the first place? What was his crime that led him there?
While he was a college student, 21 or 22 years old, he was convicted of indecency. He had had some kind of sexual exposure to a 16-year-old.
So not great.
No, not great, but he never used the internet for that, as far as we know. But several years later, after he had gotten out of prison, he served his time, was on probation, had made this Facebook. There was nothing that suggested he was using Facebook to contact more minors. He was just expressing his jubilation and praising God for beating this traffic ticket, and that sent him back to jail and as a violation of his probation.
So there's an important distinction you've laid out here, where the court, in the process of sentencing him for the original sex crime, did not say anything about you can't use social media or you can't use the internet. Now, if the judge had said something like that, it might have been a different case. But people in the North Carolina Sex Offender Registry, are they aware or were they aware of this law that prevented internet use? Did the state communicate this restriction to them? Or was Lester essentially completely unaware of this law, and the only reason he got in trouble was because someone in the police department knew about it?
Well, we assume that he knew about it because he wasn't using his real name on Facebook.
Okay.
So something made him decide not to use his real name when most people do.
Right.
But I am sure at this point now people are just given blanket notice of this law, although it's now been struck down. But prior to last month, people were being given notice. However, there was nothing in the specific terms of his probation. It was more of a, these are all the things that affect all sex offenders, regardless of whether that was a factor in the underlying crime for which he was convicted. So that's really why we have both the decision, but then also the concurrence is laying out that distinction.
And the goal of the North Carolina law is, I mean, you could call it well-intentioned, right? I mean, you have these people who are on the sex offender registry for a variety of reasons. The state is trying to prevent them from interacting with children. And while Facebook has all sorts of protections within the platform to try to bifurcate the child experience from the adult experience, we've talked about this on the show before, when you have over 1 billion users, 2 billion users, it's just not possible for any platform to completely avoid any situation like this. And maybe that's why North Carolina was passing this law. So however well-intentioned, how is this not a First Amendment violation? What is the state's argument here?
Well, so the state is arguing that, first of all, the internet isn't that important, that it's not something that is absolutely necessary, and that they have a compelling interest in protecting children, which no one will argue that. The state has a compelling interest in protecting children. However, for the particular type of First Amendment protection, or like the type of law that would stand up to the First Amendment in this case, needs to have ample alternative channels for communication, because this is cutting off so much speech. And so what the Supreme Court found was that there were not ample alternative channels to the type of speech that you have on all of these websites. Effectively, this law is so broad, it prevents someone from using the internet in general.
Yeah, because like you said earlier, it wasn't just social media. This could prevent you from doing all sorts of things, which might involve job websites. And that's, of course, an issue that was raised in the case. You know, websites like Monster or Craigslist, where you don't necessarily have to have an account to browse the available websites, but because there is that Web 2.0 element of user-generated content, which essentially is a part of almost every website that was created since 2004, right? So this is not some new thing. Then you're really barred from using the internet. Does this get into that whole issue where, just in general, anytime the government wants to place a restriction on a core fundamental right like free speech, it really has to be quote-unquote narrowly tailored? And there have to be those alternatives. So essentially the defense is saying, what is my alternative? If I can't use the internet, it's the 21st century. What is my alternative for living? How do I go about life? And even though this might seem like a mundane thing, you know, posting about not having to pay a ticket, right? That's not a very compelling thing. But of course, if Lester wants to use the internet in other ways, we already know how difficult it is for a sex offender, however rehabilitated, to get a job. That's really what the court is saying. Now, who was defending Lester? Was this his just personal attorney, or did groups who really have a compelling interest in defending the First Amendment kind of rise to his defense here?
Sure. So he had an attorney, but Cato and the ACLU both filed an amicus brief on his behalf. And Ilya Shapiro at Cato Institute was quoted in the decision as speaking to just the breadth of websites that are covered by this, and specifically ones that certainly were not the intention of the legislators who passed this law, including things like WebMD or Wikipedia or Amazon.
And of course, there's always this issue with the court and government in general of, do our representatives, whether it's you know, appointed justices, or whether it's members of Congress, or whether it's the executive branch, are they really in touch with what a young person going through life and trying to apply for jobs, do they understand that experience? Because we were talking about before we started the show how some of the justices were saying things like, well, people used to get jobs before the internet. It's not like we're cutting him off from the world completely. He doesn't have to go live in the woods and be a hermit for the rest of his life. Yes, he's on the sex offender registry. Yes, North Carolina said you can't use social media, but is that really such a broad thing that the guy can't live at all? I mean, did the justices grapple with that question of how important the internet is to be able to live in today's society?
Sure. So, while none of the Supreme Court justices got their job off of LinkedIn, there was recognition that it is fundamental to the job-seeking process, and it was something that was discussed in the oral arguments, which, if you're a millennial listening to 75-year-olds say, well, we got jobs before the internet, how did that happen? You hear that and get a little nervous. But ultimately, Kennedy, in his decision, made it very clear that they understand how fundamental the internet is to everyday interaction. And the amount of speech that we have that has absolutely nothing to do with committing crime and anything like that, that is valuable and that is protected by the First Amendment. So we saw that they came out on the right side on this issue. And if you do think about how our parents got their jobs circling things in the classifieds or going to job fairs, it's very different now. And so to cut people off from that is a problem. And one of the co-defendants, along with Lester Packingham, was an IT worker who was also on the sex offender registry in North Carolina. I'm not familiar with how he got there, But he was fired from his job as an IT worker because he could not do his job.
Right. And he has to use the internet to do his job. And because of the law that prevents the sex offender from using the internet, it essentially prevented him from getting a job. So there's your example right there if you're a justice. And if I could just make a plea to the wonderful justices on the Supreme Court, do not use yourself as a marker for comparing people, because you're not average people. You went to Ivy League law school. You got appointed to a job that you get to have for life. So however average Joe you think you are definitely not. Try to think broader than yourself.
So it's something where it's not only the job seeking process that's an issue, but it's even getting a job. How can you work in the communications field? How can you work in an office that uses Slack, for example?
Oh, we use Slack, yeah.
Lots of offices do. And so it's something that's going to directly contribute to recidivism if people aren't able to move on with their life and get a good job. And that's where this is so much more expansive than something like staying away from a school or a park, as you referenced earlier.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons why, you know, a group like Tech Freedom would be concerned about restricting the speech, however, you know, unsympathetic the victim may be, right? It comes up a lot, you know, in cases involving the First Amendment, where it's a tough case because it's about sex offense. It's about potentially people who you could view as bad or good. Maybe people don't believe that they're rehabilitated to the fullest extent. But to play devil's advocate a little bit here, you know, not in a religious freedom context, the state does have an interest, right, in protecting children, and the states have criminal law, and we do have a division of powers in the United States. And one could argue that the internet is stripping away at federalism, because every time a case comes up, it's going to go to the Supreme Court, and then it's going to set a precedent that applies to all 50 states. And we see this in tech policy all the time, where because the internet is inherently a global entity, let alone an interstate entity, the federal government can kind of hide behind the Commerce Clause and say we could do whatever we want, or because it's global and free expression is such a part of it that really what power do states have? And did some of the justices raise this issue, or essentially were just chipping away at states' ability to do legitimate things like protect children from predators, whether that be in a playground, where clearly they have the discretion and no one's challenging that, or whether it's on Facebook?
Sure. So that's a really good question. There were only two states that had this type of a law, North Carolina and Louisiana. I assume that the Louisiana law will be struck down since the North Carolina was on the same ground. Exactly. So that's something that they talked about. The reason that there was a concurrence is because three of the justices felt like, has Kennedy gone so far as to say that the state can never police the internet? And that's not what I got from Kennedy at all, either in the decision or in the oral arguments. During the oral arguments, he asked specifically of the state, is there a possibility that there could be an app that you have people put on their phone who are on the registry, and it would track certain app, like certain websites, certain apps on their phone, so that if someone has used Facebook, for example, in the past for a sex crime that they were convicted of, it would make sense. It would be very, you know, reasonably related to the underlying offense to ban them from Facebook in the future. And so Kennedy left the door open for that. He did not say the state is not allowed to police the internet. That's not at all what this case was about. It was just that this particular law went way too far.
So if we're dealing, you know, going back in time, let's say that Lester's case was internet related and that the sex crime did happen on the internet, would it be legitimate for the judge in that sentencing way back then to say, I'm going to put a restraining order on your use of social media for X number of years or something like that? That is not prohibited by the Supreme Court's ruling.
No, it would have to be related to the underlying charge, because the interest of children, if the person had this past activity that was part of perpetuating a crime, it makes sense that you would not want them to have the means to do the same thing again, both for themselves so they don't end up back in prison, but also for the public at large. So the court did not say you cannot make any laws governing the internet. And the federal government does that all the time, as you're well aware, working in tech policy. It's just a law like this that sweeps in so much speech is just way too much.
And there could be a perverse incentive here. We've talked about this on the show before in the context of extremist speech and hate speech. And there are lots of efforts around the world, particularly in Europe, to clean up the platforms and either nudge the platforms to police themselves more, effectively or more rigorously, or just to fine them or to punish them for failing to clean up their platforms. And there's always this question of, if you try to clean up the main internet, right, the internet that you and I use, are you just pushing people towards the other internet, the one that very few people in their average daily lives use, the dark web, where you go to buy drugs or you go to find child pornography? This is a thing. It exists, and there's a lot of traffic on it. And would you not just be incentivizing a former sex offender not only to have higher recidivism, which is obviously a concern, and that gets to broader questions about our criminal justice system, but are you not just pushing them into the dark web, or to push them somewhere where they're going to have their views reinforced? No one's going to challenge their behavior. If anything, they're going to be embraced because all these people are now in the dark web. Is that either something that the justice has brought up, or is that something you've thought of in the context of this case? If you are saying don't use Facebook, are you just saying use the bad internet, use the internet where you're going to be able to do nefarious things and no police department's going to be tracking you?
It's definitely a concern, and it's something I have heard other attorneys speak about, that not only does it push people towards that dark web that is much harder to regulate, but it also creates such a greater burden on probation officers who are trying to track people and keep them on the straight and narrow. So by creating probationary terms that are narrowly tailored to the actual individual, that creates a system of success for the probation officer, for them, that keeps them away from being pushed towards further crime.
And this brings up a larger question about the sex offender registry in general, which is an internet thing. And so it is, of course, relevant to tech policy, but it goes beyond that. And are we making important distinctions here? I mean, you can be on the sex offender registry for something truly heinous and terrible, and there might be a very good reason to prevent you from ever using the internet again. You could also be on the sex offender registry for peeing in public on a drunken night, or for a youthful indiscretion. Does the system make these distinctions? And if they're not making those distinctions, doesn't that just make laws like North Carolina and Louisiana that much more problematic?
Sure, I think with the best intentions in the world to protect children, legislators in some states have gone way too far. They've painted this issue with a broad brush when it really is a lot more nuanced. And like you said, it's very different to be, you know, committing the worst, most heinous sex crime with a child and a drunk frat boy who's out on a bender and pees in a park and ends up on the same list. Clearly, the punishments for those two people should be different. And the probationary terms for those two people should be different. And that's something that is the most problematic thing with this North Carolina law, is both of those people are equally affected as far as the internet is concerned. And there's just no rational reason for that, which is why the justices were unanimous in overturning the law.
Yeah, and I'll just refer everyone to an excellent podcast that grapples with this question and others. It's called In the Dark. It's about the infamous kidnapping and murder of Jacob Wetterling, a young boy who lived in Minnesota. The mother of the victim pushed very aggressively for the types of laws we're dealing with on this show, like the sex offender registry, et cetera. And when she saw the impact, and she went to these jails and she talked to these people and she saw how difficult the laws had made it for them to re-enter society, very similar to the case we're discussing on this show, she actually started advocating against those laws. Now, this woman was the victim of such a disgusting, terrible act. The case was unresolved for very, very long. And yet she sees the folly of going too far on the sex offender laws. So I would encourage everyone to check out that podcast. It's one of my favorite. Now, to close out the show, in general, is this a pro First Amendment court? You know, we have partisan divides on the court, which play out based on whether it was a Republican or a Democrat who appointed the justice. And as much as we'd all like to pretend like the court is above such politics, it's not, in my humble opinion. People can feel free to disagree with me on that. But when it comes to the First Amendment, have we actually seen a bipartisan alliance that deals with these very difficult questions where maybe a state lawmaker or a presidential candidate would never take a risk being seen as defending a sex offender the way that the ACLU has been doing that for years, and they're happy to do that, and that's part of their mission. Is this a pro-First Amendment court, and are we going to see more positive rulings in terms of people's right to use the internet?
Yeah, so they've very clearly decided that the internet is a public space deserving of a heightened level of protection than perhaps some in the government would like the internet to have, because that makes it harder to regulate. But in general, this is a very pro First Amendment court. There were three First Amendment cases in this term, Packingham, as well as Mattal v. Tam, the Slants case, which is also known as the Redskins case, where it was determined that the Patent and Trademark Office cannot deny a trademark for something that's disparaging.
Especially if the person applying for the trademark is an Asian American who's trying to reclaim the term and defang it by making it a positive thing, the name of his band, rather than a racial slur.
Sure. So that's what the band was trying to do. The Patent and Trademark Office said, we don't care. It's offensive. You can't have the patent. You can't make money off of this. And fortunately, you know, at great expense to the band and the individual members, they took this on. They won. We're thrilled for them. The other case this term was Trinity Lutheran, which took on the Missouri Blaine Amendment, saying that no state money could indirectly or directly go to a church organization. And so this was about a state program that used recycled tires to make playgrounds safer. And so the playground of the church was trying to join the program. They were one of the highest rated of the many people who applied for it, but the state said, no, Blaine Amendment, you can't have this money, even though it's for the ground of a playground.
Yeah, it was not for specifically a religious purpose, per
right.
se.
Yeah. A playground that functions as a public park on the weekends, they said, you can't have this money. And so fortunately, in a 7-2 decision, they overturned that. So in general, across the board, this court is very pro-First Amendment, and we'll see how that goes. The next term, they'll be hearing Masterpiece Cakes, which is also a First Amendment case in my world of religious freedom. So we're very optimistic that the court will keep making good pro-liberty, pro-religious freedom decisions.
And of course, as our lives continue to get more digital, and we will continue wrestling with this question of how much is the digital world similar to the virtual, or sorry, the real world, and do the laws need to be different? Can we teach old laws new tricks? These are very interesting questions we'll be grappling with on the show for many more episodes. So, Katie, thanks so much for joining the show. My guest has been Katie Glenn, Policy Counsel at the First Amendment Partnership. Where can people find out more about your work?
We are on Twitter at 1AP Online and at firstamendmentpartnership.org, the number one ST, amendmentpartnership.org.
All right. We'll link to that in the show notes. And thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.